Thursday, December 12th. Welcome into Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman Arendt.
Hi, Avi.
Hey, Cherry. Cryptocurrency.
Yes.
Five syllables. A million questions. What
so
is
many.
It? What is it? How did it become a financial force? And where is it headed over the next 4 years?
Yeah.
Because the incoming administration seems all of a sudden very friendly to it. So that's the topic of today's show, cryptocurrency. We'll start with an explainer in this segment. In the next segment, we'll talk to someone who's a skeptic and someone who's an optimist. And of course, we want to hear from you. Do you invest in crypto or does the volatility make you a little nervous? Give us a call. 888-477-9499 or email studio2@whyy.org.
And I want to have a moment of full disclosure.
Go
Before
ahead.
Before preparing for today's show, I knew nothing about cryptocurrency.
Zero.
Other than it exists. And I've read about some of the big, you know, stories of it, about it.
So you started at nothing.
But
what do
I started
you know
at
now?
Nothing. A little bit.
A little bit.
L-I-L bit. And so if you're like me, and like so many others, this show is for you.
We might get you from zero to lil. We might get you from lil to a lot. We'll see.
We shall
We got
see.
An hour to do it. Yes. We also have our Studio 2 DJ of the Woo! Day competition. We
this
do this every
This is
going to
be a good DJ of the day.
It
I
could
feel like
be
it could
very
be.
Spicy.
Yeah.
As our loyal listeners know, we end the show every week with a song picked by one of you that's related to the topic of the Thursday show. So today, we just told you the topic. It's crypto, money,
technology,
you could sort of riff off of that. Mm-hmm. You got to submit your choice for Song of the Day to studio2@whyy.org before 12:30, mm-hmm. and producer Paige will pick her favorite.
Yeah, this is not a democracy. Producer Paige is in charge of DJ
as she
of
should
the
be.
Day. Exactly. I love it. I can't wait to hear the song. And so today was a pretty big day. So we're going to have our trio of news stories
yeah.
right now.
Big
morning, because it looks like the Sixers Arena in Market East could really, really happen. This morning, Philadelphia City Council members, after several delays, finally approved a package of legislation for the Sixers Arena, which takes it out of committee, and it now goes before City Council for a final vote. We have WHYY's Aaron Lozell at Philadelphia City Hall. He was there during the vote with all the chanting and everything. Aaron, what did the Committee of the Whole agree to today?
Today, they voted out enabling legislation. This is legislation that the Sixers needs council to authorize in order to move forward with construction. So it has things to do with zoning and streetscapes and other things related to the physical development. There's also other bills related to sort of ancillary issues. But this is a big, big day for this project. If you're a supporter of this project, it is now one vote away from becoming official, and that's because Mayor Sherelle Parker has supported this project from the start, and any bills related to the arena that hit her desk, she will sign.
And there is a $60 million community benefits agreement in this bill's package, right, Aaron?
That's right. After hours of closed-door negotiations, that is the final figure that we have right now. It started at $50 million. That was the initial value part of the deal with the Sixers and the city. At one point yesterday, it had reached 100. When I came in this morning, it had gone down to 75. And then we finally ended up at 60. And that is what lawmakers voted on today.
Yeah. And I want to play a quick clip before we go ask you our final question, Aaron, because there was a lot of noise and chanting.
Commotion.
In council chambers. Take a listen to this as they approve this legislation.
All those in favor of the motion will signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed. And the motion passes.
You're all sellouts, I believe, was the chant there. Yeah.
Yeah. And so the vote was 12-4. Council member Kendra Brooks was not present. And so what does this mean as far as next steps, Aaron Lozell?
So a bit ago, Council President Kenyatta Johnson extended the city council calendar to add a regular meeting that will take place next week on the 19th. and that will be the day that they take a second and final vote. And from there, it'll go to Sherelle Parker's desk. Unclear when she'll sign it, but for all intents and purposes, it will be this deal with the Sixers will be finalized next week.
All right. Well, a couple more hurdles to clear for the Sixers. And, of course, you never know when it comes to litigation in the future, but a big day for that 76th place project in Market East. Aaron Mozell from WHYY's Plan Philly. He's been covering it from the start. Yeah. Thanks for joining us today on Studio 2.
You got it.
All right, speaking of money moving, Delaware County, Pennsylvania has approved a 23% increase in the county's share of real estate taxes over some pretty loud objections there as well. That's Delaware County Council also hearing a little bit of hubbub. WHYY's Kenny Cooper covered this. It will add approximately $185 annually to the average homeowner's tax bill in Delaware County. But county officials, Cherry said, they had to do it as COVID-19 relief funds dwindle down. They need to invest in infrastructure. And they say if we don't invest now, the bill coming due later will cost residents more.
Yeah. And so they did it over public objection here. You know, and they what was interesting there is that they've said, you know, Delaware County has suffered from underinvestment over years. So they had lower tax bills. But now it's sort of kicking the can down the road means they have to deal with what they have to deal with. So.
And of course, the political implications here are significant. This was a county that was controlled, at least in the local level, by Republicans for a long, long, long time. Only recently, I believe in 2019, Democrats earned a majority on city council. Republicans tend not to raise property taxes. Democrats are now in control and they're moving to raise property taxes. We'll see if there's a backlash from voters. Delaware County has off-year elections. The next county council elections would be in 2025, but it's not the entire council. I think it's only a couple members of the five-member body. So we'll see what shakes out there.
We will see what shakes out. Last story. It's the holiday season.
Is it?
Yes. And, you know, people spend a lot of time working. Not always at work anymore, but, you know, you work with your colleagues. And so you might want to get your coworker a gift. And NJ.com put out a list of ideas for coworker gifts.
Okay, hit me with some.
So, you know, you can they go from getting your boss something to gag gifts. Some of the more popular ones are the holiday gift basket, you know, with the meat and cheese. You can even get steak in there. Apparently, there are
a steak basket. Steak for your coworker?
They have a steak basket.
Wait, is there steak in the basket?
I mean, you can have it sent to them and have all kinds of steaks.
Okay. Because then the steak would go bad if it's sitting in the basket.
Yeah, no. They send it to you.
Got it.
You can also, some of them have chocolate in there. You can get office knickknacks, like a bobblehead with the face of your coworker on that bobblehead.
Don't like that. Don't like that.
You wouldn't want a bobblehead of your own head?
Something off about that gift. If I give you a bobblehead of you.
That's kind of weird.
It's a little weird, right?
It is weird. They have a desk yoga deck with yoga positions on these cards, and you can take one out.
This is a very tough one for me.
Yeah. And just a planter. You can get a planter made out of a dog.
I like that. Safe.
That's safe.
Wait, made out of a what?
It's like a dog. It's shaped like a dog.
Oh, okay.
And then there's a planter.
Got it.
Yeah.
Got it.
Also, cute coffee mugs. There's one that says you're on mute, and you can just kind of hold it up on the Zoom call.
I like that.
And you like tell everybody they're on mute.
I like a jokey, safe gift for a coworker because that coworker relationship, you never. It's an evolving relationship, and you never know when it's going to start and when it's going to end. It's not quite like family, but you're very close to that person, right? And I think it's just a tricky one. You really have to walk a tightrope with the coworker gift.
And the gift that I think stood out to me the most was a desktop pickleball set.
I don't even know what that means.
I would not get that because I feel like if you were cube mates, that would be annoying.
I don't even understand what it is.
It's like they have balls. They have the pickleball paddles. They're little. They're miniature, though. And you can like play desktop pickleball. And I feel like that would get on my nerves.
Against your coworker? With yourself?
You and I could probably do it in our little Studio 2 cube.
As if the office didn't hate us enough already. Okay, so maybe you could get your coworker some Bitcoin.
Maybe.
I mean, that would be a very generous gift, right?
It would. Or it depends on the day, though. It depends on the day. And so that moves us right on into our main topic, cryptocurrency. You know how to tease a topic. You may have heard that Bitcoin hit $100,000 yesterday, and that's the second time in a little over a week. Now, this record high price comes after some crypto-friendly appointments by President-elect Trump and expectations that the new administration will be all in for the digital currency.
But while crypto boosters are cheering, other financial experts remain skeptical and warn that Bitcoin is as volatile as ever. So today we're going to debate the future of cryptocurrency and ask if it lives up to the hype. But before we do all of that, we're going to get a little primer on digital currencies, because I'm not sure I could explain exactly what a blockchain is or how a string of code can be worth $100,000. So we asked New York Times reporter David Yaffe Bellany, who covers the crypto industry, to be our guide today. David, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
And to you, our listeners, our question of the day is, what do you think of cryptocurrency? Are you investing in it, or does the volatility make you too nervous? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org.
So, David, I am imagining you've been in this scenario. You're at a family gathering. You're at the bar with some friends, and they know that you cover this thing called cryptocurrency, but they're like, David, level with me. What the heck is this? How do you explain it to a layperson?
Well, first of all, I'll say usually the question at the bar is like, what should I invest in now?
How can I make some money, David?
So you're asking a different type of question. But, you know, what is it? I mean, the history of cryptocurrency dates back to the period after the financial crisis in 2008. And basically, the original vision was to create a type of money that people could transact with without having to go through a bank or some other kind of financial intermediary. So, you know, something that you could kind of send instantly over the internet, you know, there wouldn't be the same sorts of fees and hassles associated with it that you get with sort of like international wire transfers and that type of thing. That was kind of the original vision of you know, what became Bitcoin. You know, Bitcoin has some other uses as well. But then since then, it's sort of blown up into this gigantic industry, and really people treat cryptocurrencies now more as investments than as, you know, money that they're going to transact with. So, you know, they'll buy a certain coin just hoping that its price will go up and that their investment will rise in value.
How do you explain the technology that undergirds all of this? We know the word blockchain, but I don't think many of us really understand what it is. What is the novel technology that makes this possible?
So you can think of a blockchain as sort of a giant spreadsheet that kind of records transactions, and it's publicly viewable. And so when person A sends, you know, a Bitcoin to person B, that's sort of recorded on the blockchain, which means that everybody can see it. You know, the name of the person isn't there, but kind of a string of letters and numbers that's unique and associated with that person is there. And so you can sort of see kind of the flow of money from one person to the other. And you can kind of ensure through the sort of, you know, algorithmic process by which the money is exchanged that, you know, if someone, you know, says that they're sending you X amount of Bitcoin, that they actually have that, because it's all kind of publicly visible.
So how do you assign value to a particular piece of cryptocurrency? It's like, how do you say this is worth X amount of whatever? Like, how do you to determine the value?
You could think of it as similar to the traditional stock market, where it's worth as much as people are willing to pay for it, essentially, and the kind of market forces determine that. You know, if so, you know, as the price of Bitcoin has gone up, that's because people are able to sell it and find a buyer at a certain price, and sort of that's what determines it. You know, in the traditional stock market, though, you've got typically got like business fundamentals that underpin, you know, how much a share is worth. You know, Amazon just unveiled a great new product, so, you know, the Amazon stock is worth more today, basically. And that doesn't really exist with crypto. It's sort of much more of a kind of mystery about, you know, how sort of prices are kind of going up and down. But it's the market that determines it.
Wow.
Within the ecosystem of a single coin, so let's say Bitcoin, how is more created? Like, how is a new Bitcoin minted, or what controls the supply of available Bitcoin?
So one important thing to know about Bitcoin is that the supply is limited. There will only ever be 21 million Bitcoin in circulation, and not all those Bitcoin are out there yet. The way that new ones are created is a sort of process called Bitcoin mining that you've probably heard about. And basically, it's a bunch of kind of computers around the world sort of plugged into the Bitcoin network that are kind of running software that solves sort of mathematical problems. And, that process is designed to kind of keep the whole system running, to sort of ensure that, transactions happen as they're supposed to, that, person A really does have the amount of Bitcoin that they're sending to person B. And through that process of kind of running your computer to sustain the network, you're rewarded with new Bitcoin. And that's why, it's sort of metaphorically described as mining, because not only are you just like keeping the whole system ticking, you're being rewarded with new Bitcoin. That's how you get kind of a new one.
Yeah, and you talked about a little bit about people coming up to you at the bar to say which Bitcoin, or not necessarily Bitcoin, but which cryptocurrency should they invest in? How do you sort of determine which type of currency is the one that's more valuable than the other? Which one is a safe investment versus a more specious investment? How do you make that determination?
Well, if anybody claims to you that they can make that determination,
They don't know.
way very quickly because nobody really knows. But I mean, like, look, people who are really deep in the industry would say, okay, there's this new cryptocurrency that's associated with like an exciting new company in the crypto world or an exciting new application of the technology. And, they think that the price of that currency will go up because it's sort of used as part of that platform that they think has all sorts of promise associated with it. So that's sort of like an explanation you'd get from the industry. But frequently you see coins go up for totally random reasons. I mean, there's like a Luigi Mangione coin now, right? Because like
Wow.
about him. And that's the sort of like what's known as the kind of meme coin sphere of the crypto world. And prices can shoot up really quickly, but they can also go down really quickly. This is a world that's full of scams, full of fraud. And so I would urge, anyone who's considering investing in it to be really, really careful about what they put their money into.
I'm sorry to backtrack here, but I'm still trying to understand, David. So you say, like, for in the example of Bitcoin, there's only ever going to be 21 million. And that they're still actively being mined by these computers around the world. But when you talk about traditional currency, like when it comes to the US dollar, I can imagine who is deciding to mint more dollars, the government, and how they're doing it, right? They're literally physically making them. Who is deciding the pace at which these new coin become available? Like, is there a who that's in charge, or is it like completely dispersed and there isn't a who?
There really is no who. And if you talk to kind of Bitcoin enthusiasts, that's a huge appeal of this. I mean, partly what they're doing is fighting back against a system where a government can just print more money, resulting in inflation. This is one of the kind of key arguments that kind of undergirds the Bitcoin movement. We need a sort of form of value that's scarce and which can't be diluted by kind of constant sort of money printing. And so that, cap to the number of Bitcoin that will ever be out there is kind of programmed into the original Bitcoin code. And the pace at which new Bitcoin is released is just sort of like dependent on how many of those computers are running and how fast they're running. And it's not something that any single person can control. It's
Got
this
it.
kind of distributed network.
Could I ask if this metaphor makes sense? Like, so at some point, a group of people set like a perpetual motion machine sort of off, and it's just sort of doing its thing. This perpetual motion device has been sort of set off into the world, and at this point, no one really can stop it, can slow it, can speed it up. Is that about right?
Yeah, that's I think a reasonable way to think about it. The Bitcoin software was released, back in 2008 by a kind of anonymous coder named Satoshi Nakamoto. It's sort of one of the most amazing stories in the history of technology. Nobody knows who this guy is, despite numerous attempts to unmask him. And once he put it out there, it kind of took on a life of its own and sort of kept running and running and running. And there is no Bitcoin incorporated that oversees it. There's no Bitcoin government that controls it. And so it sort of keeps running on its own. And whatever you think about it is a pretty impressive feat that this idea has turned into this investment asset that's arguably the most successful profit-making asset in the financial world of the last 20 years?
I just think about all the stories that I've read about cryptocurrency, and I think about FTX and the fall of FTX and Sam Bankman-Fried. And I just think about, you know, folks talking about whether or not crypto needs to be regulated. And now we have President-elect Donald Trump, who just a couple years ago was a crypto skeptic, but has since appointed or has nominated a person who is very much an advocate for cryptocurrency. Can you talk about specifically President-elect Trump's sort of transformation in this area and what it says about the future of cryptocurrency?
So you're right. Trump was initially a major crypto skeptic. He said that Bitcoin was a scam, that it was designed to undermine the US dollar. And he said that while he was in office during his first term, the Securities and Exchange Commission under Trump brought some of the kind of original kind of cases against the crypto industry that you hear crypto people complain about. But he did a total 180 on the campaign trail this year. And there are a lot of possible explanations for it. What Trump and Trump's family say is the explanation, and we actually got some insight into this week at a crypto conference in Abu Dhabi where Eric Trump spoke, is that kind of after January 6th, the Trump organization and Trump family members felt like they were being locked out of the financial system. Banks were less willing to work with them. They felt sort of demonized, and they were sort of in the market for an alternative form of finance, and that's what kind of initially, you know, made crypto seem attractive and appealing to them. That's sort of the kind of Trump line. There's also a clear kind of political motive for embracing crypto, which is that the industry spent a massive, unprecedented amount of money
yeah.
during the 2024 election. I mean, we're talking on the order of $130 million spent on congressional races. And, you know, it's one of the most aggressive spending sprees by any single industry since Citizens United. And, you know, that sends a clear message to politicians, which is that, you know, get on board or we're going to come for you. So, you know, that also is, I think, certainly an explanation for why Trump kind of embraced crypto.
Does getting on board mean regulation? And what would that look like? Any idea? And we only have about a minute and a half or so left in this segment.
Sure. You know, crypto people famously say that they want regulation, but they want the type of regulation that, you know, they feel like would help the industry. They want a legislation passed that would defang the SEC and basically move oversight of the crypto industry to the CFTC, the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, which is a much smaller, much less aggressive regulatory body in Washington. And, you know, it's something that consumer advocates are really worried about because they think it could lead to kind of more of the sort of, you know, harms that we've seen customers face over the years.
Real quick, just 30 seconds. Even if there's no sort of like substantial regulatory change, just the fact that there is a supportive administration in one of the most powerful countries in the world, what will that have an effect in and of itself?
It's already had an effect. Yeah. It's part of the reason that Bitcoin surged to $100,000. It's created a lot of confidence in the market that crypto will thrive, that it's here to stay in the United States, and that's already boosted prices.
And so we're having this conversation to take people from know nothing to knowing a little something.
And you helped crypto a lot. New York Times reporter David Yaffe. Bellany, thanks so much for your time this morning.
And coming up, we're going to hear from a crypto skeptic and a crypto optimist about the future of this technology. That's coming up next on Studio 2 after this break.
And get your comments in, folks. Studio2@whyy.org. You can also call us 888-477-9499. We'll be right back on Studio 2.
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolf-Manarant. We are talking about cryptocurrency today and its future. Is it the future? President-elect Trump has made a number of pro-crypto appointments. And with that news, Bitcoin, the largest cryptocurrency, surged to an all-time high of $100,000.
So, does cryptocurrency live up to the hype? Will it replace the dollar, as proponents predict, or is it just still too volatile to ever become a mainstream investment and currency? We have two guests with us to discuss this. We have Lee Reiners, a lecturing fellow at Duke University and a crypto skeptic. Welcome, Lee, to Studio 2.
Thanks for having me.
We also have Danny Nelson, a reporter and editor of CoinDesk. And Danny is a crypto optimist. Welcome to Studio 2, Danny.
Great to be here.
And our listeners, we have the question for you today is, what do you think about cryptocurrency? Are you investing in it, or does it look still feel too volatile and make you too nervous to make that type of investment? You can call us 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org.
Wasn't planning to do this, but I actually want to start with a caller.
Yeah, let's do it.
This is Grayson from Abington, who wants to talk about how he got into crypto.
Yeah.
Grayson, you're on Studio 2. Tell us your story.
Hi, guys. So I went from knowing absolutely nothing about investing to now I check the market a couple times each day and over the period of the past 2 years. When I was in grad school, Bitcoin was $20,000 per coin. And the metric that I used to decide when I should make a purchase would be anytime I heard Bitcoin mentioned in the news on NPR, actually. So if on my way to work or way to school, I heard a morning edition that they said Bitcoin has risen to 30K or whatever, I would put another $100 or $200 into Bitcoin. And now I'd say that cryptocurrency makes up about 25% of my portfolio, and it is indeed very volatile. For instance, since I've been on hold, the price has swung $500.
Oh, my God.
And so, yeah, it is super volatile, but it's volatile in one very clear direction, if you ask me, and that's going upwards. And obviously, I have a much more sophisticated approach now than I did when I started.
Grayson from Abington, fascinating call. The NPR strategy to investment. I can't personally recommend it, but I'm intrigued. So let's go back to our guests now who we introduced a moment ago. And I'll start with you, Danny Nelson, reporter and editor from CoinDesk. So, Danny, we already have a financial system. I get money from my employer. I'm allowed to turn that into goods and services that help me survive and sometimes even enjoy myself. Seems like an okay system. Why do we even need an alternative?
Well, first, to Grayson's point, I actually think that if you hear it on NPR, I love NPR, but if you hear it on NPR, that's the time you got to sell.
Oh, interesting. Break that down.
That's when everyone's talking about it. That's when everyone's getting really excited, and that means the price is going to go up a lot, and usually something that is followed by a washout, and it goes back down. So it's sort of like if you read about something, a meme in the New York Times, you know it's not cool anymore. But Grayson is right. It has been, I guess, volatile in one direction over the long run. To your point with the volatility, I think with regards to actually using Bitcoin as a currency, right? Is that what you were asking?
Well, why do we even need an alternative? Like, we have a financial system, and I'm not saying it's perfect, but it allows people all over the world all the time to sort of turn money into real things or services that they use. So why do we need some sort of alternative to that?
Yeah, so I think from my experience as a reporter at CoinDesk, we're a global news organization. We write about cryptocurrency everywhere. In the past, we've had colleagues in Russia. Now, I'm talking about a time before the war and all that. But when we wanted to pay someone in Russia, it's not very easy, even back then, to move money from the U.S. banking system to the Russian system. You obviously can't just Venmo or Zelle them, and you can't write them a check either. And so for a moment like that, when it's just normal people doing a job, one way of moving value around the world is with Bitcoin. I buy Bitcoin here. I wasn't personally doing this, but my company was. Yeah. We buy Bitcoin. We send it to our colleague. She's able to sell it for rubles because Bitcoin is traded around the world. Now, in those minutes that the transaction is happening, it might move, the price might move in one direction or another a little bit, but it's still solving an actual problem of how do we move money around the world when
there's diplomatic uncertainty,
exactly.
When there's real world stuff that gets in the way.
Yeah, and you see other examples of this in, let's say, migrants and people like that who also want to make remittance payments back to their countries. There are systems to do that, Western Union, things like that. They take 10% fees, and Bitcoin stands in there as a way to move value. And so that's why there's some I would say, actual societal benefit to a Bitcoin. Now, does that mean that it should be worth $100,000?
Yeah.
I don't know if that's the reason why it should be or shouldn't be, but it definitely, in my mind, means that it's worth something.
It has intrinsic value.
Yeah, it does. And, you know, that stands a little bit against when people say Bitcoin isn't backed by anything. Well, they're right. It's not backed by gold. It's not backed by the U.S. government. It's not backed by anything. It's backed by sentiment and how people, well, it trades on sentiment and how people feel about it, but it does solve a problem of how do we, in a global world, move money when when governments don't want us to. And there are good sides of that, and there are also bad sides of that.
Yeah. I want you, you're a crypto optimist. And so tell me what makes you feel confident or what opportunities you see in crypto.
I think it's, so I guess I would call myself an optimist. I'm not a rah-rah person because I am a reporter. So even though I'm more of a, I guess I would say pro-crypto than David, who I've worked with, we cover the SBF trial together. Mm-hmm. So we're good friends. But, you know, there are different approaches that different organizations in the news media take to cryptocurrency. New York Times, you're not allowed to touch the stuff. At the CoinDesk, we're allowed to play around with cryptocurrency, to buy it, to sell it, to understand how it works in order to write about it. I think that I'm optimistic about it because it allows for people to create new ways of doing business. Sometimes the ways that they create those businesses get ahead of what they should be doing, and that can be troublesome, I guess you could say. But I think that it is something that is going to continue to have value, whether or not the price is always going up.
Yeah.
Let's bring in another caller now. Mm-hmm. This is Craig from Morganville on line 3. And I think Craig might set us up for a bit of a counterpoint from Lee Reiners. So let's start with Craig from Morganville. Craig, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
I actually have two comments. One is, this is computer driven, is it not? Can this not be hacked? Can somebody pull the plug? Who controls the algorithm? And the algorithm is never perfect. And if it screws things up, the value can be changed. Also, international deals on a legal level with other countries is done in U.S. dollars. What is that going to do? And oil is internationally traded in dollars. What's going to happen with that?
So it could weaken America's position as a financial power. Okay, so that's Craig from Morganville.
A lot of questions from Craig.
Talking about some downsides. So let me set up now Lee Reiners, lecturing fellow at Duke University. What are some of the drawbacks of cryptocurrency as it exists now?
Well, there are a lot. And going back to sort of Danny's answer there, I think when you look at crypto, you have to sort of separate the potential from the reality. And the crypto industry is very good at marketing and pointing to what are very real problems in the traditional financial system. And just look at what happened in 2008 to get a sense of what can go wrong. And at the end of the day, you know, our financial system consists of intermediaries, and they're not fulfilling this intermediary role out of the goodness of their heart, right? They're charging a fee. And these fees can be quite expensive. So just think of, you know, the credit card swipe fee that merchants have to pay. Danny alluded to, you know, fees for international, money transmission through Western Union and whatnot. So the premise of crypto was to just do away with these intermediaries, create a way to send payments peer-to-peer instantaneously without relying on any intermediaries, right? So that was the potential. But when we look at the reality, as we've already discussed, it's being used principally for speculation. It's not being used for payments. If you were a merchant, why would you accept payment in something that can go down by 20% because of an Elon Musk tweet, for instance, right? Conversely, if you thought it was going to go up, why would you ever give it away to pay for something, right? And so again, the reality is that the crypto ecosystem now consists of nothing but intermediaries, right? The way people buy crypto is through cryptocurrency exchanges, which are intermediaries. So all we've done, all the crypto economy has done, is swapped out one set of intermediaries, right, you know, regulated traditional financial institutions, with a new set of intermediaries who are essentially unregulated. And we've seen how that has played out, you know, with the FTX debacle. Now, as to the downsides, you know, there are many. I think your listeners are going to be familiar with ransomware. You know, thousands of companies, you know, nonprofits, hospitals, school systems have been hit by ransomware attacks over the past decade or so, and every single one of those hackers demands payment in cryptocurrency. We know that crypto is being used to evade sanctions. For instance, in Russia, you know, after Russia invaded Ukraine, the U.S. implemented economic sanctions. Russia is using crypto to bypass those. The Wall Street Journal reported on how Hamas used crypto to fund, in part, its October 7th attack in Israel. Crypto is being used to facilitate all sorts of scams. So, you know, romance scams, also known as sort of pig butchering scams, where, you know, someone establishes a relationship with the victim, and then
why is crypto used in that way?
Crypto.
Like, because we, the underlying because technology of crypto is that it's a ledger and everything's being recorded. So it seems in some ways counterintuitive that it's being used by people who don't want to be traced.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, it's a lot easier to send a large amount of crypto than it is dollars, right? I mean, that's why it's used. And to David's point at the top of the show, yes, the blockchain is transparent, but you're only known by this string of alphanumeric characters, right? So it's pseudonymous. You know, so no one knows, you know, who is transacting. And so, yeah, you can track the flow on the blockchain, but you need to be able to tie a real-world identity to that alphanumeric string of characters, which is really, really difficult. And even if you can identify them, they have to be located in a country where you can get to them. And so a lot of these scams and attacks are happening in Russia, other countries that are not very friendly with the U.S. So that's why.
Yeah, I want to bring in another caller. We have Matt from Wyomissing, Pennsylvania. Matt, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Oh, my comment was just that, yes, that cryptocurrency, it gives the ability for people to transfer value without an intermediary for large sums of money across the world. That's really all my comment is.
Thank you, Matt. I have a question, and I'm not sure, you know, which of you would be the best person to ask this to, but every time I read about crypto, it's either an extreme where somebody's getting super rich or somebody's going broke, right? Or committing some crazy fraud. What does the average crypto investor look like? How much money do they typically make? And maybe, Danny, you're the person to ask this question. Like, what does it look like for just a regular Joe Degular to invest in this and they're not on the extremes? What does that look like?
Well, so Grayson, I think, mentioned at the top of the show, his portfolio was 25% in cryptocurrency. I think he said that. Now, I'm not here to say what people should or shouldn't do. That is, though, a lot of money, especially for
that's
something
atypical.
It's very I think that's generally atypical in the crypto industry, in the people that I talk to every day when I'm writing about all the things that are happening in the time between the mainstream media writing about the extremes. The people that I talk to are, they could be 100% in crypto, but that is definitely not the norm. They're the ones who are working in it. I think that a normal person, it's definitely a male audience, a younger millennial type of individual, I would say, just from going to conferences and things like that. But it's not a good way to just get rich quick. If you're going to get into crypto because you want to get rich quick, you're probably going to expose yourself to very bad ideas because there are lots of people out there that want to take your money. And to Lee's point, there's a lot of scams out there that can do it properly, that can easily take your money because it's a lot easier to move cryptocurrency than it is to move a lot of dollars. So
it's more frictionless.
Much more frictionless, right.
Look, a lot of listeners are asking about the environmental impact of this.
Yes.
Laura and Nick, and we have a caller now, Julie from Marion Station. Julie, you're on Studio 2. It seems like you have some concerns about the environmental impact of cryptocurrency. Is that right?
Yes. I know that it uses a lot of energy, and I just right now read something that I'd like to quickly read to you. The energy consumption of all crypto assets combined is between 0.4 and 0.9% of annual global electricity usage, or 120 to 240 billion kilowatt hours per year. That's more energy usage than all the world's data centers combined. Crypto is a big energy user.
Okay, so could you address that? I'll give that to you, Danny, because there is clearly an environmental impact when it comes to crypto. But of course, banks use energy. Mm-hmm. They have lights. They have mm-hmm. buildings. You know, bankers drive cars. Give us a sense of the energy usage vis-a-vis the traditional financial system, the way you see it.
Yeah. So just to start with, when we talk about the energy use of crypto, we're really just talking about the energy use of Bitcoin. Without getting too much into it, most cryptocurrencies don't use a very energy-intensive process to function, but the Bitcoin mining process is, it does require basically lots of different computers all over the world to race against each other and burning electricity. And it is a very big consumer. I'm not an expert in energy markets, so I don't know if it's fair to compare
apples to apples
to the banking system. It certainly takes more energy to move Bitcoin than it does to move to wire money from point A to point B. But just for some little bit of context, when we're thinking about data centers and all the energy that the computers are gobbling up, the biggest problem that we have to think about right now isn't Bitcoin, because whether or not Bitcoin exists isn't going to change the outcome that I think we're unfortunately headed towards as a globe. But AI data centers that are being built up all around the world, those are only going to take up more and more energy. And this is not to deflect from what I think are valid concerns about Bitcoin's energy use. It's just to put into context, it's not exactly fair just to pick on Bitcoin when we're not talking about all of these other only growing energy demands with AI.
Yeah. Regina asked this question. How do we spend a cryptocurrency? Do we cash it out and get real money? And I think that question kind of goes, I think, to Lee. I want to bring you back into the conversation because a lot of people have no idea how to get into cryptocurrency. And to me, I have people I know that put money in and lost every dollar. And mm-hmm. and they feel, you know, how do you even determine whether or not something is a good investment or a bad investment? Because there's really no laws that sort of protect consumers.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very volatile asset class. I mean, you know, nothing I say should be construed as investment advice. But what I tell my students is, you know, look, treat it like you're going to the casino and don't bring more than you're willing to lose. So, you know, back to Grayson's 25% of his portfolio, I mean, I think that's probably a little on the high side without knowing much about Grayson's financial situation. So, you know, look, when you look at traditional financial assets, right, like stocks or bonds, okay, a professional investor is going to look at what is the current market price, and then what do I think that price will be in the future? And the method that they come to that future price is going to be established in, you know, tried and tested sort of valuation methodologies. Generally, it'll be some sort of discounted cash flow. So a company is going to generate revenue in the future, and you're going to discount those future revenues to the present time to determine whether or not you should buy or sell that asset. Well, that methodology doesn't work when you apply it to crypto because there's no cash flow, there's no revenue, there's no balance sheet, there's nothing. So again, to Danny's point, it trades entirely on sentiment. And so if you're buying it, you're buying it with the implicit and perhaps the explicit expectation that someone else is going to be willing to buy that from you at a later date for a higher price.
So I think Danny said it wasn't entirely on sentiment, though, that there is underpinning it like a service that it offers, which is the ability to get money out of places that are hard to get mm-hmm. money out of, whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, but that there is some value at the bedrock of it. I mean, what do you make of that, Lee?
Well, I mean, again, value is in the eye of the beholder. So certainly that's going to be valuable to some people. Now, I don't know if that means it's $100,000 value.
Right.
Right. So, I mean, again, yeah, I'm not denying that it can't be used for good by some people. You know, that's really not a problem that we have necessarily in the U.S., but certainly if you live in, you know, Venezuela, Argentina, or something like that, then this might be an attractive option for you. So, again, I would just be extremely cautious. Now, you know, how do you get it? Again, there's cryptocurrency exchanges, but sort of the big development over the past year is the rollout of Bitcoin exchange-traded funds, or ETFs. So now we have BlackRock, sort of a well-known, well-established traditional financial institution that you know, runs many ETFs that are familiar with many investors. Now you can get exposure to Bitcoin by buying an ETF, and you don't have to worry about using a cryptocurrency exchange. You can hold it in your traditional brokerage account. And so, you know, I think that has certainly propelled a lot of the price movement over the past year or so.
But feel more comfortable.
Just because we're short on time, let me then ask one more question here, because what I hear Lee describing is a growing interdependence between the traditional financial system and this supposedly independent means of exchange. I mean, is that the direction we're headed, Danny, where these things are not so much separate from each other, but actually inextricably intertwined with each other?
They are inextricably intertwined, and it didn't start that way. It started with Satoshi, this mysterious person putting out code on the internet and a white paper and a weird community of cypherpunks coming together and creating little economies around it. And over time, you know, it went from cents to dollars to hundreds to thousands to now $100,000. And as that's happened, banks and financial institutions look at it and say, well, there's obviously demand for this. What can we do to make money on this? And so that does chip away a little bit at the, I would say, philosophical origins of this, what was first called peer-to-peer electronic cash. Basically, let's create a brand new financial system that doesn't rely at all. And now what we do see is a lot of the way people get access to crypto is through those banks. And, you know, that's just, I think,
that's a long journey and not many years. But
Yeah. And we want to say thank you. We have to leave it there and say thank you to our guests, Lee Reiners, law professor at Duke University and crypto skeptic here, Danny Nelson, reporter with CoinDesk, and our crypto optimist. We appreciate both of your inputs today.
Thank you.
And our DJ of the day is Bobby with For the Love of Money by the OJs. You got to love a Philly pick. Honorable mention to Bill from Westmount Area with What a Fool Believes by the Doobie Brothers. Studio 2 is produced by Debbie Builder, Paige Marie Besser, Andreas Copes, Al Banks, and Tina Calique engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCoy. Joan Isabella is WHYY's audio general manager from Studio 2. At WHYY in Philly, I'm Avi Wolfman-Arrant.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Thank you so much for joining us today.